Most people I've known want to be able to enjoy their jobs as much as the bricklayers in our reading this morning. And I wish I could have been there to ask him, what about his job made him enjoy it so much at a time when, in a 2013 Gallup poll, 70% of people responded that they hate their jobs. Everyone should be able to at least tolerate their job. And I can't help but wonder if a lot of that hate has to do with working for jobs that don't appreciate their workers' labor or don't compensate them enough. I've been there. When we look back at the history of work in America, quite often hating our jobs has been the least of our worries. Do you know the story of our opening hymn this morning? I used the title printed in the hymnal, but I also let you know its commonly known title, Bread and Roses, and I made a joke that I think every folk musician has to gain their cred by covering it at least once. Everyone from Joan Baez to John Denver has covered it. The words are a reference to a speech by American feminist, socialist, and union organizer Rose Scheiderman, who later inspired a poem which drew attention to the phrase. Scheiderman famously declared, "When what the woman who labors wants is the right to live, not simply exist, the right to life as the rich woman has the right to life, and the sun and music and art. You have nothing that the humblest worker has not a right to have also. The worker must have bread, but she must have roses too. Help, you women of privilege, give her the ballot to fight with." Bold words for 1912. The idea is that while, yes, people need bread or food to survive, that's not all that's needed for a flourishing human being. We all need to be able to enjoy ourselves as well. And that's where the roses come in. Roses has often been used in the past as a symbol of enjoying life, as in the oft-repeated reminder to make sure to leave enough time to stop and smell the roses. We need things in our lives that make them worth living, beyond the bare necessities of survival, and towards a richer actualization of life. Now, the phrase is also commonly associated with the 1912 textile strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which is commonly called the Bread and Roses Strike. See, the work week had recently been cut from 56 hours a week to 54 hours a week, which may sound like a minor victory for labor and movement towards a more reasonable and just set of working standards. But those mill owners in Lawrence soon found a way to compensate by slashing the pay of their workers at the same time they were working less. Now, workers in Lawrence were already impoverished. Many were immigrants, and they were forced to live in apartments with multiple families, often surviving off of beans, molasses, and bread. One worker would later testify before Congress, "When we eat meat, it seems like a holiday, especially for the children." The child mortality rate was an appalling 50% by age 6. 36 out of every 100 people who worked in the mills died before the age of 25. The average life expectancy for a Lawrence mill worker was only 39. Conditions in Lawrence were inhumane, and that seems to be an understatement. Not only did they not have the roses they needed to flourish, they didn't even have the bare necessities of survival. The only consideration the mill owners were giving was to their bottom line, making conditions ripe for revolution. The laborers went on strike when it became clear that the mill owners were going to institute a pay cut. And the city government quickly overreacted, sending in the militia to patrol the streets and to harass workers. In one case, a member of the local school board even tried to frame the strikers by planting dynamite in strategic points throughout the city. At least 3 strikers died in the strike and in its aftermath. The parallels between that strike and modern actions can't be ignored, such as media and political hyper-focus on any actions of violence and destruction, and an attempt to show that the strikers were mere violent thugs. Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW, leaders Bill Haywood and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn were responsible for orchestrating the signature move of the strike. See, they knew they were never going to be able to be as violent as the government. They knew that nonviolence in itself was not going to move much. So they rounded up the hungry children of the strikers and sent them by train to sympathetic families in New York, New Jersey, and Vermont. There, they garnered widespread sympathy. The government didn't like that, and they sent police to stop children from being sent out. And after a clash at the Lawrence train station, congressional inquiries would soon reveal the depth of suffering in Lawrence, and the mill owners, embarrassed and seeing no other way out, soon settled the strike by giving the organizers a 20% increase in their wages. I've chosen to focus on the Bread and Roses strike this morning because it's such a clear example of the need for both bread and roses in one's life. Even the workers who did have enough to eat were not enjoying their lives. As much death as circled Lawrence, it must have been nearly impossible to truly flourish. Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs famously asserts that when one is focused on basic needs of survival, one cannot possibly expect to fulfill higher level needs leading up to self-actualization. As you can tell, I'm very sympathetic to the labor movement. During the Industrial Revolution, as more and more people depended on industry for their livelihoods, unscrupulous bosses would frequently take advantage of workers, as the textile mills did in Lawrence, creating unsafe work conditions which did not give a damn about whether their employees found fulfillment or not. Labor rose as a reaction to this, seeing it as necessity to organize for the rights of workers. They realized that bosses were not going to grant the workers their rights without a fight, and labor sought to do just this, leading to a stark improvement in working conditions and safety, a standard work week, and eventually, during the Great Depression, minimum wage, required overtime, and the banning of child labor among their very many accomplishments. You can thank the labor unions and the labor movement for the fact that working class people can lead long, fulfilling lives today. Things might not be perfect, but if your boss can't look at you and say you're working 60 hours this week for no additional pay, thank labor. And I'm aware of how relevant this history is to the Copper Country as well, especially now that I'm right around the corner from the Italian Hall disaster site, where 68 men, women, and mostly children were trampled to death when what looks like an anti-unionist yelled fire in a crowded building. Unions were very much a force for humanitarian and political change during the mining boom here. The accomplishments of labor weren't often taught when I was in school, and I hope that's changed today, because we need to remember them now more than ever. That's the original purpose of Labor Day. As I told Ellie, it's not just the teachers got together and decided to be nice and give an extra day off before they started school. Or it's not to be just another three-day weekend to mark the end of summer, but to celebrate the accomplishments of the labor movement. Unfortunately, over time, the labor movement has weakened, and a proliferation of jobs, mostly in the service industry, have appeared for low-skilled workers, which perpetuate their poverty and don't allow for even a basic level of sustenance. What we need today is a new strengthened labor movement that not only reaches out to traditional union occupations, but also includes these working poor. I support the labor movement because I know firsthand how difficult it can be to get by as a worker in America. My parents were both working class, often subsisting on substandard incomes in professions where unions were prohibited. As a divorced woman working a minimum wage job at a fast food restaurant in the late 80s, my mother was often faced with the prospect of getting by on $134 a week before taxes, at a time when she was not receiving near enough support. Have you ever tried to raise a preteen on such paltry wages? If you have, you know it's practically impossible. And I know my mother skipped meals to make it happen. There were times we had neither bread nor roses. And this is exactly the situation for so many of the working poor in America today, who are being discouraged or forbidden from organizing in unions, which would give workers the ability to bargain for their livelihoods. Consider these statistics collected by my colleague, Aaron McEmerys. 1 out of every 5 workers who actively supported a union are fired during the organizing campaign. 92% of employers force employees to attend mandatory anti-union meetings where it is illegal for pro-union workers to respond. Over 50% of all employers threaten to close the plant if the union wins, although less than 1% actually do close after Election Day. And to add insult to injury, 34% of employers refuse to negotiate contracts with workers even after the workers have formed a union through the National Labor Relations Board. This is exactly the same tactic that tyrants around the world use when elections don't go their way. They just ignore the results. Luckily, my mother got a raise and eventually another job, which didn't help massively, but kept us out of abject poverty. Not everyone is so lucky. And a minimum wage full-time worker today can expect, if they are lucky enough to get a full-time job, $290 before taxes a week. But many subsist on part-time work or tip work, and tip workers can be paid even less. Make no mistake, we're in this situation because the owning class have gradually pushed back the accomplishments of labor organizers, as they did in Lawrence almost immediately following the Bread and Roses strike. Our second principle, which we're focusing on this month, justice, compassion, and equity in human relations, calls on us to engage in the struggle against economic inequality. which the labor movement so valiantly fought against, by demanding that people treat each other in a decent manner that allots them their share of bread and roses. The struggle continues today because people cannot be reasonably expected to get by on $290 or less in most parts of the United States today. That's why Unitarian Universalists have such a long history of supporting union causes. When I was a member of Upper Chapel in Sheffield, I used to love listening to one of the older members tell me stories about messing with the bosses as a member of the union and later a senior union organizer. And indeed, as far back as William Ellery Channing and Theodore Parker, two of the founders of Unitarianism in America, there have been people in our faith struggling to achieve rights for workers. Unitarian minister John Haynes Holmes, writing in 1912, put it best. He summarized many of the injustices of labor at his time, but it might be best summarized by saying, poverty in this age, as in every age in our country, as in every country, is primarily due to the fact of social injustice, that natural resources, which are the basis of all wealth, are in the hands of a few instead of under the control of society at large, and are thus exploited for the benefit of the few and not for the sake of the common welfare. That the distribution of wealth is grossly unfair and disproportionate. In the final analysis, that society is organized upon a basis of injustice and not of justice, and is permeated by the spirit of selfishness and not of love. This is why we Unitarian Universalists do social justice sermons. Because when you don't even have enough to survive, how can you think about lofty spiritual goals like enlightenment? Today, our principles call Unitarian Universalists to engage in the struggles for laborers, especially in this day and age when largely even middle-class people are finding it harder and harder to make ends meet. If we say that all people have inherent worth and dignity, then they cannot fully realize what this principle says unless they have both bread and roses, the necessity of survival, and the ability to live self-actualized lives. At the June General Assembly in New Orleans, delegates adopted a statement of conscience which reaffirms many of these points and call on Unitarian Universalists everywhere to work towards alleviating economic inequality. Our board is currently considering ways we can engage our congregation with this statement of conscience, including the possibility of making it a congregational justice issue. I encourage each of us to think about this and to find the statement of inequality and read it. And we can think, how can we engage this both individually and as a congregation? One way we can do this is by supporting labor organizing, locally, regionally, and nationally. This system that we live in, which places the majority of economic resources in the hands of a small number of people, to the point others are barely able to survive, is unjust and, dare I say the word, evil. Supporting labor organizing is the first step towards telling our elected officials that it's wrong to ignore the basic needs of all people in our system. It could be discouraging that over a century after the Bread and Roses strike, many of the advances of the labor movement seem to be in danger of being rolled back, largely because of political expediency and public detachment. Unitarian Universalism offers a base for providing a place of religious resistance to economic injustice, if we but allow ourselves to be such. May we ever be a religion that struggles to tell all people that they have a right to their bread and roses. May it be so.